All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've got a very powerful, very concerning show today, a show that should knock you back in your seat. If you're at all sentient, if you have a conscience and a heart, you're going to want to hear this show. And it's going to get you angry, but it's also going to put you at that corner where epistemology meets morality. And you're going to have to decide that if something is wrong, you got to stand up and do something about it, okay? So back at the back end of the show, we're going to be rebroadcasting an interview I did about a year ago with Dr. James Cavallaro, who's part of the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And we're going to be talking about a study they did, which was called Living Under Drones. Now, this is a study that's a little bit more than a year old, but it's very, very relevant for today. And I really think, given what we've seen over just the last week, not to mention what we've seen over the last year in terms of drone attacks, this is an important thing for people to be paying attention to. And joining us for this first segment is Madiha Tahir, who's an independent journalist and who has followed the issue of drone attacks on Pakistan for quite some time. She's also co-edited a volume of essays, Dispatches from Pakistan, and she's currently a doctoral student at Columbia University. And as I said before, she is the director of a powerful new film called Wounds of Waziristan. Madiha, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this because I really want to get a chance to talk with you about this. Give people a sense of what your film is about.
Well, my film is a short documentary that is, it's not a film about drones. It's a film about drone survivors. And what I wanted to get at in this documentary was to get beyond the legal questions into a discussion about what it means concretely and materially for people to live under drones. And so we interviewed several people, and out of those several interviews, I took two of them and made this documentary. And it includes Karim Khan, who is an older gentleman who lost a son and a brother to a drone attack in 2009. And it includes a young teenage boy who lost a months-old niece to a drone strike in March 2010.
Well, what made you, and you know, it's interesting that you said that. I think that's a really important distinction that you wanted to make basically a film about the impact of drones on people living under these drone attacks. What made you feel compelled to make this film?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been an independent journalist in Pakistan, and I follow a variety of stories. But, you know, as I was freelancing in Pakistan as a journalist, I sort of had the opportunity to meet Karim Khan and then to meet his lawyer, Shahzad Akhtar, and I began to follow the issue more closely. And I think in the United States, you know, I would move back and forth between Pakistan and the United States. Here, much of the discussion for a long time has focused on the legal issues, whether drone attacks are legal or not. That discussion tends to conflate the issue of ethics and politics with the issue of legal questions. And I wanted to get past those questions because even if things are legal, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are just or even that they are politically useful. So I wanted to focus on people who have actually lived through an attack and to try and think about what happens in the wake of an attack, because we tend to think about attacks and drone attacks in terms of the number of people that have been killed. But actually, I think what we fail to see are the people who are left behind and the kinds of loss that they have to struggle with and deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah, I want to get into that in just a minute, but I want to actually continue along this vein a little bit more. The idea of even how you made this film, because when you look at it, you know, you make a point in the film about this is a tribal area, it's a remote area, all this other stuff, but it must have been somewhat difficult and somewhat dangerous for you to get in there. I read somewhere where you actually weren't able to have access to all of Waziristan, and you had to go places where you could meet people as they came into town to buy food or whatnot. But how did you make it, and was it difficult, and was it dangerous?
Right. So Waziristan is broken into two administrative units, North Waziristan and South Waziristan. Both of them are blockaded by the Pakistan Army. You cannot get into North Waziristan, where the bulk of the drone attacks happen, at all. And you can get into South Waziristan, but you can only do so if you embed with the Army, which I have not done. So I did not go into either North or South Waziristan. I went to Bannu, which is a town on the border of North Waziristan. And there, people from within North Waziristan come there daily to conduct their daily activities. There are students from North Waziristan who go to university there. There are other businessmen or people just doing daily, you know, life activities. who come in. And so that's where I went, and, you know, there to get a sense of, have conversations with people from North Waziristan and to get a sense of, you know, what they thought about the situation and about the attacks. But the actual interviews we actually conducted in Islamabad, because it's simply not safe to actually move around and do that kind of work openly in that region.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Madiha Tahir. And Madiha is she's a journalist, an independent journalist, and she's also a author, and she's the director of a powerful short documentary film called Wounds of Waziristan. Tell me this, mm-hmm. Madiha. Waziristan, what is it that, you know, you make a point in the film that Waziristan has been it's been like a focal point of so much from various imperial empires throughout its history. It's been a focal point of so much, you know, attacks and warfare and whatnot. Why the concentration here, both historically, but also particularly in terms of drone warfare?
You're right. Waziristan and the tribal areas, what are now called the federally administered tribal areas, which are on the border, in the northwest border of Pakistan, have a long history of violence being enacted on them. They, you know, under British rule, the British actually separated this area in an agreement with the Afghan king and used it as a buffer zone between British India on the one side and Afghanistan on the other, and enacted a set of really brutal regulations called the Frontier Crimes Regulations, which are still in effect today. So these are 1901 era regulations that are still actually used by the Pakistani government now to govern the Waziristan and the tribal areas more generally. And what they are is they allow for collective punishment, they allow for arbitrary detention, there is no functioning court system. There's basically an appointed political agent who used to be a British man, and now it's a Pakistani, who essentially rules on behalf of the federal government and has a great amount of power in the lives of the people who live there. You know, the tribal area did not get the right to vote till 1996. It is only in this last election that they were able to actually have political parties were actually allowed to function in this area. So there's a very long history of colonial rule in this area that then, post-independence, gets taken up by the Pakistani state. And after independence, what happened is that area continued to be used by the Pakistani military for its own battle in India with India over Kashmir. Then in the 80s, this area was again used by the U.S. In tandem with the Pakistani military again to raise the Mujahideen and fight against the Soviet Union. And now you're seeing the consequences of that Cold War and really all of that very long system of violence, you know, playing out now post 9/11 in the American so-called war on terror.
So Waziristan actually has some strategic significance for the U.S. in terms of in relation to Afghanistan too, right?
Yes, I mean, after 9/11, after the U.S. Occupied Afghanistan, a lot of the some of the resistance then moved into this area, and you know, well, there are two things to be said. One is that the insurgents in this area have been absolutely brutal for the ordinary people who live there. They have, you know, they conduct beheadings. I mean, they're just absolutely ruthless, right? But that is not why the U.S. is conducting these drone attacks. The U.S. is conducting these drone attacks not in order to protect the Waziris in this area, but rather to protect its own occupation and protect its own soldiers in Afghanistan, against whom these insurgents also launch attacks. And so that's the reason. That's been part of the reason for the drone attacks.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Madiha Tahir. And Madiha is she's a journalist, an independent journalist, and she's also a author, and she's the director of a powerful short documentary film called Wounds of Waziristan. Now, these attacks have been going on since 2004, and your film, as you said, paints a picture of life under these kinds of conditions. And you describe that life as living existing among the dead. Let's talk about that.
Yes. So this is what I was saying before. Basically, the idea for the film comes out of a speech that President Obama made in May this year, in which he said that he is haunted by the loss of civilian life in Pakistan and elsewhere as a result of U.S. policies, but that nevertheless, one had to continue with these policies, including drone attacks. And I thought that was an interesting statement because to be haunted means that one is daily, deals daily with disruption. I mean, even if you think about ghost stories, that is what they are. If you think about horror films, that's what it is. The person that is haunted is somebody who's unable to continue their normal, ordinary life, so you cannot simply go on. And so I wanted to think very seriously about that because when I have talked to people, both on camera and off camera, in conversations, survivors have told me about the kinds of stress and trauma that they deal with. There's an incredible amount of psychological stress in this area from the drones themselves, but also from in the wake of these attacks. I met one teenage boy who had both of his legs amputated, and he has since passed away because of his injuries. And he wouldn't go around to the side of the house where the attack had happened because he was afraid that it would happen again. He also suffered from nightmares, and I've talked to other people who have had similar issues. So people in this area live with the daily fear of these attacks. And secondly, they deal with the trauma of losing loved ones, I mean, losing family members. One of the people in my documentary, you know, he survived a drone attack, but he's so devastated by it that he almost just does not want to, he wishes that he had not survived. Because because he lost his niece and he lost his sister-in-law in the process. And these are, you know, closely knit extended families that are being destroyed in these attacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that your film brings home very, very powerfully too is this: the whole overall terrorism that's been unleashed against people. And as you're talking about that also brings with it this all kinds of psychological problems. And I was thinking about this in terms of the constant, someone who speaks in the film who speaks about the constant buzzing of the drones and a relationship between certainty and uncertainty. The uncertainty when you have a sky filled with 7 or 8 drones and they're up there and they're buzzing and they're doing all this stuff, and there's the uncertainty of when they'll attack combined with the certainty that they are going to attack, which is, it must be an incredibly horrifying situation to be living under.
Yes, I mean, when I've spoken with psychiatrists who deal with survivors, what they have told me is that what happens is that with the drone attacks, is a particular kind of trauma. So these people are also under attack, as I said, from the insurgents and the militants in this area. So with the militancy, whether it's true or not, one has the feeling that one has some degree of control. You can avoid the militants, you cannot get in their way, et cetera, et cetera. With drones, you actually don't have any sense of any kind of control because there's no communication going on. They're just in the sky, and at some point, usually at night, they tend to fly low and will attack. Most of the attacks happen at night. So that creates a particular kind of stress in which there is a complete lack of control where your daily life can just literally be torn apart in a second without any kind of ability to change that.
You know, one of the things that one of the people in your film is talking about, that after a drone attack, you don't really find bodies so much as you find body parts. And it struck me, I mean, one, there's the horror of that, but then there's also this point about the total and complete dehumanization that's being done to the people who live there. You know, that it's a remarkable and horrifying thing to happen. And I think in terms of being able to justify the whole idea of drone warfare and attacking these people in Waziristan, who I would venture to say that the vast majority of the people in this country have no idea even where Waziristan is or what it's doing there or what's happening there. But at the very least, even if they learn about it, all they're going to hear is that, well, there's a lot of bad people there and we have to take them out. And so what we're doing is justified and legal, whether you like it or not. And it's part of being able to say that and do that and get over with that rides on the dehumanization of the people there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that dehumanization precedes the actual attack. That dehumanization is part of the Islamophobia in the U.S. in the ways in which Muslims are dehumanized or in the ways in which people from particular countries are read as being Muslim and then dehumanized. And then when the attack happens, you know, the interesting thing is that insurgents also do this. They Often when they kill people, they will sever the body into pieces. And the reason for doing that is to disallow closure for the family. And this is exactly what happens with a drone attack as well, is that you are digging through the rubble for leftover body parts in order so that you might may be able to have a funeral. So the family is not able to get closure. On the ground, there's hardly a distinction in what happens in the wake of an attack and what happens after militants attack. So I think the question for the United States is, by what terms, by what logic does it make sense to put these people, these Yazidis, under conditions of terror so that the U.S. and Americans can feel safe? And I'm not sure that there's an answer to that question.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Madiha Tahir. And Madiha is she's a journalist, an independent journalist, and she's also an author, and she's the director of a powerful short documentary film called Wounds of Waziristan. Well, what do you think about this point that Obama has made continuously, and something that I find particularly abhorrent, is the idea that, as I said, there's this whole sort of idea that's being put out there that really, even if we take out some innocent people, that we're working for a greater good because there are bad people here. And I'd like to know what you've run into as you've gone around and spoken to people around the country and people have seen your film and whatnot. What do you think the impact of that kind of thing has, both on the people in Waziristan, but also on the people here who seem to not only tolerate but accept the idea of drone warfare is a necessary evil?
Yeah, I mean, I think that has been repeated so much in the United States that people do, by and large, buy it. But the question is, what is the question to which drones are the answer? Yes, there might be bad people there. There's certainly bad people there as far as the Yazidis are concerned, who are the ones who are actually dealing with the daily costs of having the militancy in that area. But what has happened in this area is that for a long time, the Pakistani state has allowed a political vacuum to exist. That political vacuum is what allowed these insurgents to then take root. Not only that, but the Pakistani state has consistently treated the people in this area as basically non-citizens, meted out collective punishment. So, for example, when soldiers were attacked earlier this year, they suddenly imposed a blanket curfew on the area for close to a month. Last year, when the militants decided that there would be no more polio vaccinations, the Pakistani, the political agent in that area, decided that in retaliation, any person, any Waziri who decided to comply with the militants' demands and did not have their child vaccinated for polio, that they would not receive any kind of legal papers. They would not get identity cards or property papers adjudicated or any of the stuff that they need for their daily lives. So basically, people are caught in the middle of this fight, and it really wrecks their lives completely.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I'll tell you, Madiha, because one of the things, and to me, look, I don't think there's anything at all that can justify what's being done to the people in Waziristan and Pakistan as a whole, to the entire region, Afghanistan, the entire region, frankly, most of the world. What the U.S. does to people cannot ever in any sense be justified. And I look at this and I keep thinking, though, you know, it's really concerning at the very least, and that's a very mild way to put it, that people aren't out in the squares of the city, you know, with pitchforks and torches and saying, no, we are not going to allow this to continue happening. And I keep thinking about, I don't know, you know, it's sort of like, think about this. If the U.S. was not doing what it was doing in that region of the world, how would things look different? And even the growth, in a lot of ways, the growth of Islamic fundamentalists and people who are, you know, are terrorists or whatever, you know, and are reaching out and attacking the U.S. This is not coming out of nowhere. It's coming out of a whole history and a whole experience of what the U.S. has done to people, what the system has actually created among peoples in terms of their life conditions, whether it's being carried out by British imperialism or U.S. imperialism or anything else. But there's really a fundamental cause that's very different than just sort of, well, there's somehow bad people there. The bad people there, in my mind, really are the U.S. military and the people operating the drones and the government and Obama, frankly, who's presiding over it all.
Absolutely. I mean, this political extremism that uses the rhetoric of Islam has a very long history, and that history is very much intertwined with the history of U.S. intervention and U.S. capitalism and what it has done in these areas, whether it's the Middle East or it's Pakistan, South Asia. you know, with respect to people not coming out in the streets, yeah, Americans, it's interesting that Americans are so complacent about these strikes, because when you look at the poll numbers here, there is opposition to even the use of surveillance drones within the United States, but there is widespread support for the use of killer drones elsewhere. And that can't be explained without a certain degree of racialization that we were talking about earlier, and the sense of Islamophobia that pervades American mainstream today. You know, but I think there are communities that can understand this in the United States. What the U.S. is doing, I think we tend to think of things that happen in the colonies as being brought back to the center, right? So in many ways, the drones have been tested abroad, and now they will, in one shape or form or another, will be brought back to the United States. But the other side of it is that things that have been happening in the U.S. are now being globalized. So, you know, there is a certain parallel between what has happened with Trayvon Martin and what happens in the tribal areas. So, for example, you know, the fact that when Trayvon Martin is killed, and we have a national conversation about the fact that this child looked suspicious because he was wearing a black hoodie, we are effectively saying that he was guilty for his own death because he appeared suspicious. And that is the same logic as when President Obama says that a military-age male in a strike zone is guilty if he is guilty simply by the fact that he was in the strike zone, because therefore he was suspicious. In other words, for people who are not white, the onus is on them to not appear suspicious. And if they appear suspicious, then it's their fault for being killed.
Exactly. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Madiha Tahir. And Madiha is she's a journalist, an independent journalist, and she's also a author, and she's the director of a powerful short documentary film called Wounds of Waziristan. Let me ask one last question. What do the people in Waziristan, in your experience of the people you've spoken with, what do they think of the U.S.? And you had a great closing comment in your film, but I just wanted to know what the you had some older gentleman talking about the, you know, what he thought of the alignment of things in the world. What do people think of the U.S.? People in Waziristan think of the U.S.?
I think survivors in particular, if you talk to them, they are absolutely incensed, and they recognize that the Pakistani military has been working with the United States to effectively to wreak havoc in Waziristan, in and around their homes. I think more broadly, when you talk to people in the tribal areas, the problem is that because they're dealing with three forms of violence, right? So they're dealing with the drone attacks, they're dealing with the militants, and they're dealing with the indiscriminate attacks that the Pakistani army also launches in these areas at times. So depending on who you're talking to, people that have been affected by the militancy will say, you know, I don't care. My brother was killed by, you know, a militant. Let them drone attack over there and kill people. So there's a lot of confusion in that sense, driven, and it's understandable. I mean, it's driven by the fact they're caught between these three forms of violences. And I think the question for the rest of us is, why are those the choices? Why are we only giving them the choice of either drones or, you know, Pakistani military operations? Why does it come down to these awful, awful choices and forms of violence?
Exactly. And one of the things I'd say, though, I do have to say, though, and I'm going to tell people what this, you know, older guy says at the end of your film, and he just looks at the camera and he says, the greatest terrorist in the world is the United States. And I thought it capped a whole lot of sentiment there for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, survivors will say that. I mean, I've had more than one survivor say that to me, and it's hard to argue with them, because their argument is that they are sitting in their own homes. It is the United States that is the superpower. It is the United States that has invaded that region. It is the United States that's flying the drones and dropping Hellfire missiles on their homes. So in that context, how can you possibly call them terrorists?
Right, exactly. Madiha, thank you very much for joining us today. And tell people, when will they be able to see your film?
So our film did air on Democracy Now!, and we have just been picked up by a distribution company, Journeyman TV, so hopefully we will have it out soon.
All right, thank you very much. I look forward to it. I look forward to a lot of people being able to see it. Take care now.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Madiha Tahir. And Madiha is she's a journalist, an independent journalist, and she's also a author, and she's the director of a powerful short documentary film called Wounds of Waziristan. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jim Cavallaro from the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic, and we'll be talking about the report, Living Under Drones. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Slackers with International War Criminal. And that song today goes out to the king of kings of war criminals, Barack Obama. Yep, you heard it. I said it. You heard it. And you know it. This man has committed more war crimes than any other president in the history of this country. And yet people still seem to be getting fooled by him. Wake up. We won't talk about that anymore. Instead, we will be talking with James Cavallaro. James is a professor of law, director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford University. And Jim is he was involved in this new report, that came out at the end of September. And that report was called Living Under Drones. And the report was co-authored with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Sure. You know, your study was just a mind-pounding study. I mean, you know, you sit here and anybody who's paid attention at what's going on in the world, and particularly in that region of the world, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that whole area of the world, the idea of this drone warfare, we hear it constantly, continuously. And, you know, some people are outraged, but really, generally, there's not enough outrage. And part of that, I think, comes from people looking at this as sort of a very clean, very surgical sort of, this is sort of just the way that war is conducted today. And actually, it's a nicer war. There's not as many American boys being killed in a war like this. Your study kind of slams that all to hell and says that the narrative, the entire narrative around drone warfare is false. Can you tell our listeners what you're talking about there?
Well, to start, it's worth spending a bit of time on what the narrative has been. And I think you summarize it well. What I would add is the idea that has been dominant in mainstream media in the United States, and this is largely fostered by the official discourse, the main idea has been that drones and drone strikes are surgically precise, that the only casualties caused by drone strikes are terrorists. And since that has been the main narrative, naturally, it has served, among other things, to mute opposition to drones. We were very concerned by this narrative because information that we had and also others and organizations had approached us to see if we would be interested in investigating independently what the consequences of drones and drone strikes actually has been in Pakistan. And we took up that challenge and spent pretty much the year 2012 to date, investigating intensely what have been the consequences of drones and drone strikes in Pakistan. And the result of our work is the report that you cited, Living Under Drones. But in a sentence, and of course I'm happy to get into much more detail on this, is the dominant narrative of surgically precise strikes that hit only terrorists is simply false. That, in fact, drones hit civilians, drones hit all sorts of buildings, and that drones have a significant impact on entire communities who are on a daily basis terrorized by these unmanned vehicles flying overhead that at any moment can fire down a Hellfire missile that can kill anyone who happens to be within the blast radius.
Well, let's jump into this one at a time here, because one of the things that you just said about it's, you know, supposedly the narrative being it doesn't hit civilians, you're arguing that, in fact, it does. Civilians are deeply impacted, in fact, killed by it, killed by these this drone warfare. And this is something that really, you know, well, look, frankly, we're living in a situation where the U.S. government basically says, you know, what did Brennan say? It was in the single digits, or there's virtually none. No civilians have been killed. You know, nobody in the U.S. regime actually admits to significant civilian murder in as a result of these drone of this drone warfare. How do you speak to that?
Well, first, what's important, and there was an important piece written by Joe Becker and Scott Shane in late May in the New York Times, and that piece investigated the process by which drones are authorized, or at least some drones, and some drone strikes, rather. And I can get into the details of what the focus of that piece was and what could and should still be considered in more depth. But one of the very important revelations in that piece was that the administration counts those who are killed in a strike, if they are males of combatant age, which is quite a broad range, if a male in the relevant age range is killed in a drone strike, the administration considers that person to be a combatant unless there is posthumous evidence demonstrating that person's innocence. So think about that. Take a second. Wrap your head around that. What it means is if the United States fires a Hellfire missile from a drone and it kills some group of men, the United States considers that they're all militants. Well, of course, if that's your calculation method for establishing who is a militant or a combatant, of course your figures for non-militant or non-combatant deaths will be low. In fact, the presumption should be of innocence of those who were killed, and there should be some examination, a thorough examination into who the victims are. That's one of the major concerns that we had in this report, and one of the issues which we need needs significant response and attention as soon as possible from the administration. But even without that mischaracterization of those who have been targeted, there is plenty of information, and we went through all the information in media sources and in what are called data aggregators, and there are three major data aggregators, and even the most conservative data aggregators, with whom we have significant issues because of their undercounting, even they are talking about scores and scores, if not hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And the most reliable data aggregator has calculated up to as many as 800, nearly 900 civilians killed. So the single digits narrative is fantasy, and it's highly problematic because what it does is it allows most people in the United States to accept the false narrative of surgically precise, terrorist-only weapons, almost as though these weapons were able to go down to a house level, knock on the door, establish that the person is a terrorist by overwhelming evidence, establish that the person is imminently plotting and about to strike and kill Americans, and then and only then killing the person. That's what it allows people to believe when that's not the case.
Yeah. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford. And Jim and the clinic there are one of the co-authors of a new report on drone warfare in Pakistan called Living Under Drones, and it just came out at the end of September. You get a chance, look that up, Living Under Drones. You're never going to be the same after reading it. Now, Jim, one of the things when you're talking about this, the idea that, and it always struck me, especially when I saw this thing, and I'm familiar with the New York Times article you were, referring to, and when I saw this thing about they clear up any mistakes posthumously. I mean, one, I think you're right. It's sort of, you would think that they would, you know, make that clarification, make that decision before they killed somebody. But even there's a certain cynicism and a real deep, disgusting, unreal thing in there, because posthumously after being hit by a drone is a pretty gruesome affair from what I understand in your report. It seems like that's actually almost a given that that's not going to happen.
Well, let me put it this way, because we can't know everything, and there's so much secrecy surrounding the U.S. drone practices. Virtually everything is shrouded, unfortunately, in an inappropriate secrecy, and evidently there's some margin that we understand for national security that might be legitimately invoked, but it's been used to cover everything related to the drone program, including its very existence. But again, you know, what we know from the way drones work is those who are very close to the blast radius are incinerated. So it would be highly difficult, at a minimum, to establish information about those victims. But what I can say is we are unaware of any serious, comprehensive effort by the United States to find out almost anything about those who are struck by drones. And we also are aware of the fact that in many instances, authorities have been unable even to identify those who have been killed, much less to establish who the person was, what the person was doing, if the person was a combatant, etc. So, yes, you're right. There's very little to suggest that there is any significant attempt posthumously to exonerate those who have been killed, which leaves you with, if you were killed, you were a combatant. And then if you roll that backwards, what does that do, that knowledge that drone operators and administrators and administration authorities have, that if they make a mistake or if they target the wrong people, is unlikely to be any consequence? What does that do to their targeting decision and their willingness to fire drones? I don't know, but it's a question that concerns me.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing you guys raised in the report that really, really sort of just smacked me in the head is the point that they often describe, and you see this in the press all the time, they describe the victims of, or the targets, because they don't really ever talk about victims of, they talk about the targets of the drone attacks are all militants, which is a phrase you actually call for at the end of your report. You guys call for actually stop using the term militants so easily and start trying to define people as what they are, because militants does seem to be a word that's been thrown around to obfuscate everything that's really going on there. What's the story with that?
Yeah, it is, and I don't want to head too far into the realm of legalese, but militant is a term that sounds as though it legitimates or justifies the killing of the person, so that if a person is a militant, then that person could be killed by a drone. And that's not the case under international law. In order for a target to be legitimate under international humanitarian law, the laws of war, the person would not only have to be a combatant, but the person would have to be engaged in an activity that imminently threatens interests that the United States could protect, like, say, U.S. lives or interests in Afghanistan across the border, and there would have to be no means of capturing that person. So a person could be a militant or a combatant, not be posing a threat to U.S. interests, and or be subject to capture. And if any of those are the case, in other words, if the person is not presenting a threat to the United States, or if the person could be captured, then that person should not be killed by a drone strike, or could not or should not legally. So that's one issue, which is very important, is who can the United States kill or might it be able to kill legally, and who can it not kill? But secondarily, and this is in many ways the bigger issue, what we've seen in the mainstream media is that the reporting on drone strikes in an area known as Fatah, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which is an area of extremely difficult access because of the terrain, but also because it's cordoned off by the Pakistani military, it's an area in which you simply can't enter. And what media sources have done is report, in effect, verbatim information from anonymous security officials about who was killed. So anonymous security officials who evidently have an interest in saying that those who they killed were combatants, as opposed to, hey, we killed a bunch of civilians today, they tell the media anonymously what they want the media to print, and the media then obediently, unfortunately, in many, many instances, has simply printed what they are asked to print by anonymous sources. We don't think that that's an appropriate role for an aggressive democratic media, And one of the things that we call on is for journalists to speak more critically about who are their sources and also to interrogate what they're saying. So that if the only source for the assertion that all of those who were killed are militants is an anonymous security official, maybe if you're a journalist, you say, we don't know who they are. They're people. They're men. Some people or some anonymous sources said they were militants, as opposed to militant, 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 militant throughout the article. So there is some responsibility here on the part of the media.
Tell me this, Jim. How does this add up when you throw in something that was, again, and I keep saying, it keeps, as you read the report, you keep getting more and more outraged. The idea of double tapping. Can you explain to my listeners what double tapping is and what that says about this, the civilian targeting?
So double tapping refers to a practice where a drone will fire a Hellfire missile, a first strike, and then shortly afterwards fire a second strike. And there have been a significant number of cases where this has been documented to have occurred in Pakistan. What that means in practice is there's a missile strike. It hits a target. It has a blast radius. There may be a number of people who are killed or maimed or injured in the blast radius. And now what's happened is when others, first responders, have gone in to assist those who are injured and may still be alive, a second strike kills them. And because that has happened so frequently, unfortunately, in an area known as North Waziristan, which is the epicenter of these strikes, the people with whom we spoke, and we spoke with 70 people from that area who had been directly affected by drone strikes, they told us that they won't go into an area where a drone has struck because they're afraid that they'll be the victim of a second strike. And we had some really gruesome testimony of people who were near enough to strikes to see victims, and the victims are screaming, and people won't go in to help them because they're afraid they'll be hit by another strike. But there's an important point here, Michael, which if I could elaborate here, is the nature of the drone strikes, double tapping, as it's called, is one phenomenon, is such that because people don't know when drones are going to strike, all sorts of ordinary activities have been affected in these areas, and people are suffering from significant psychological trauma, according to the symptoms that they described to us, and also according to the interviews that we did with mental health professionals who have treated people from that area.
Yeah, I want to get into that in just a second, but I want to remind listeners that we're talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law and the founding director of Stanford Law School's International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And that clinic is one of the co-authors, along with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, of a brand new study that's really worth you going out, finding the study, reading it, and thinking a whole hell of a lot on it. And then think about what you're going to do after you read that and understand what's going on. And the study is called Living Under Drones. Now, Jim, you're started to talk about that, the Living Under Drones. What's the impact on this? I mean, as I understood, one of the things that blew my mind was when, you know, and I think there was somebody who was part of your team or part of the I can't remember whether it was with Stanford or NYU, Jennifer Gibson, I think her name was.
Jennifer Gibson was part of our research team at Stanford, and then graduated and has now working with an organization based in London.
Right. Well, she wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times where she talked about how so many of us think that a drone strike is like sort of, it comes in, the drone comes in, one or two of them come in, just appear out of nowhere, and that they fire a single missile or two missiles or whatever into a crowd of people, and then they disappear. She said, actually, you're talking about a situation where 24/7 people are living under the threat of drones, literally. Is that the case?
Well, so here's what we were able to document. You know, I went to Pakistan twice for a couple of weeks and spent time speaking with, again, this group of 70 people who in several trips came and met with us who live in areas where drones fly overhead and who were directly affected because some of them themselves had been injured or maimed by drone strikes, or they'd lost a relative or many relatives, or because they'd had drones hovering over and had fired down Hellfire missiles in their communities. So these are people who are living constantly under drones. And what they told us, and this was really probably what really had the greatest impact on us, as much as the death and destruction and maiming evidently has an impact on anyone, what they told us is, the drones in their communities hover overhead at times 24 hours a day, for several days on end. They emit a buzzing sound, and we spoke with many, many people, and they would imitate the sound like a bee. It's something that even when they're sleeping, it's there, and it's in the back of their heads. And they have no idea when one of these drones will fire a hellfire missile down on their communities. They also don't know where it will hit or who it will hit. So imagine what this does to them on a daily basis. They're walking in the bazaar. They don't want to get too close to someone if they don't know who that person is, because maybe that person is suspected of being a combatant by the drone operator, and maybe a drone will hit that person. And if it does, and if I'm within 15 or 20 yards, I will be killed by the shrapnel. So that's the logic, and what it's done is it's cast a pall on all sorts of activities. People told us, for instance, they don't go out of their houses unless they have to. They don't congregate with three or four men anymore. They don't go to religious services. They don't go to funerals. In short, they do. And here's the worst is, many people told us they don't send their children to school anymore because they don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to be. They don't know if they're going to wander into an area where there's a group of men that might look to someone in, say, Nevada, who's watching a video image, like a group of militants or combatants. So the entire community has been profoundly affected. And the other major effect, evidently related to the first, are the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms of other psychological maladies, of stress-related disorders, that many people with whom we spoke told us about their suffering themselves and of many others in their community suffering. And I would say in a short sentence, the United States has not declared war on Pakistan and is not officially engaged in a war in North Waziristan. But the narratives of the people in that area were narratives that sounded like people living in a war zone. That's the way the people living under drones experience drones and drone strikes.
I'll tell you, it's incredible. You know, Jim, I want to, and let me remind listeners again, we're talking with Jim Cavallaro from Stanford, and he's one of the co-authors of a new study called Living Under Drones. Jim, tell me this, and we're running up on our time, so I want to make sure we get a chance to speak to this, and I know you were careful not to get into all the legalese and legalisms in terms of language before, but a significant part of your study actually does raise the question of the legality or illegality of all this, and that really strikes me because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, you know, how many crimes are going to be allowed to be committed? And to me, it really, you know, from my own viewpoint, after reading your study and my own thinking about it beforehand, these kinds of things, at the very least, must violate half a dozen international law. You know, it just seems to me humanitarian law has to be violated time and time again in the process of this whole drone warfare system. What did you guys find about that?
So I'll try and be succinct, but let me start by saying there is significant evidence, and we've pulled it together in this report, and there are other sources as well that demonstrate that there is every likelihood that many drone strikes have occurred in violation of international law. But here's what makes it a tricky, and this is part of, I would say, the strategy, although I can't speak to knowingly what the strategy of the administration is, but it seems as though this may be what they've been thinking. You can imagine a hypothetical scenario. One can imagine where there is a person in North Waziristan, a combatant, and the combatant is about to fire a missile, and the missile will strike and kill I don't know how many Americans in Afghanistan, hypothetically. Okay? And there's no way to arrest this person, and the person has the missile and is about to fire it, is about to strike it. And in that circumstance, one can imagine, well, it might be legal under those circumstances as described for the U.S. or someone to use some sort of lethal military strike, such as a drone, to attack that person before the person who is about to imminently attack and kill many Americans can fire the missile he's about to fire, right? So you can imagine, you can work into the intellectual possibility of that occurring. Here's what happens. Because that intellectual possibility occurs, and because the United States has taken measures to close off investigations, to shroud drone strikes in secrecy, to unfortunately to make sure that media do not know what's happening. The administration is able to say, our strikes are legal. We won't provide any basis for why that's true. We won't let you know what the legal memoranda say. We won't let you know the specifics of what happened in any of these cases. But because there's some theoretical, hypothetical possibility that maybe there could be a legally valid drone strike, we're just going to tell you they're legal. Now go away, stop investigating, and report what I tell you. That's what we've gotten. And that simply is not good enough in a democracy. It's not good enough with a media that should be concerned about human life, and it's not good enough with a society of citizens who should be concerned about human life anywhere, not just in the United States, but human life in Pakistan. And it should also concern us when we know that 176 children, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, have been killed by drone strikes in Pakistan, and as many as 880 civilians. So there are very, very serious legal questions that need to be answered, and I don't think they're going to be answered until people get outraged and demand those answers from authorities.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, though. It's one thing for people to think about people doing that, and it's really important, because here you look at it, and you guys make a point in your study that since Obama came into office, the number of drone strikes and the devastation caused by drones has just increased immensely in 3 years. I mean, it's
five or six times, exactly.
Yeah. And people keep turning away and turning a blind eye to this. And I was thinking, even these things of, like you were talking about those things that he talked about in terms of a personality strike in a certain sense, if you're going after one person and you think they got this. And while that's bad enough, he also has instituted these things called signature strikes, which to me, just by the very description of them, the character of them, Jesus, what are we thinking that we could sit and say, okay, this makes sense to me. Tell people what a signature strike is, and what do you think about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. What's most worrisome about the drone practices of the United States are the signature strikes. So let's just go through what the difference is. A personality strike is one where an individual has been identified. The United States military or CIA authorities know who the person is. They have reason to know that the person is involved in al-Qaeda or the Taliban and is plotting an incident imminently, represents a threat, can't be arrested, all of that criteria that would have to be filled, and they decide to target that person. Let's put that to the side. And we should put that to the side because all evidence suggests that that kind of strike, a personality strike, is a small percentage of the strikes that have taken place, particularly in recent years. Where most strikes occur is in what's called the signature strike context. And what does that mean? It means that people who are watching the videos, the images taken by drones, they're watching those images, God knows where, possibly at some CIA location, undisclosed location in the United States, in Nevada, elsewhere. They're watching those images, and they assess from those images, based on the pattern of activity, that the people that they're looking at are combatants, that those people are plotting or engaged imminently in an attack on U.S. Interests, and that they can't be captured. At least that's what they're telling us. And when they establish all that from the video screen, then they fire one Hellfire missile and maybe a second when first responders come to kill those people. That's almost certainly where most of the deaths have occurred. And that is far beyond where a lot of the focus of the media has been in recent months, particularly since the New York Times article that we referred to earlier by Joe Becker and Scott Shane, which talked about Obama's role in making decisions about the first kind of strike, the personality strikes, where the individual who is targeted is known. The focus has been on personality strikes, even though most of the deaths almost certainly have occurred in signature strikes, where someone is looking at a video image and deciding, oh, these people, they're probably up to no good. They're probably doing something that will have lethal consequences for the United States. We don't think we'll arrest them, so we'll kill them. That is a context which, again, I think should raise all sorts of red flags.
Absolutely. And Jim, one last thing, just so people can have this on their minds as they go about their business after hearing this interview, the numbers. What are the numbers involved?
The numbers of people killed?
Yes.
Well, we're looking at, you know, unfortunately several thousand now in Pakistan, and again there are others in Yemen, but that wasn't the focus of our report. But the numbers, the best source, which is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, had the numbers through September, through early September, at between 2,562 and 3,325 people, of whom they were able to classify, with all of the ambiguity in the information, between 474 and 881 as civilians and 176 as children. And again, many more of those could be civilians, but there's not enough information to know that. So, you know, significant numbers. If you look at the numbers of people killed, it's on the order of people who were killed in 9/11.
All right, Jim, we're going to have to wrap this up now. But before we go, where can people find the study?
So the site is livingunderdronesaltogether.org. And there they can find the study. There's a video. There's all sorts of resources relevant to this issue. And hopefully, one thing I'll say is this is an issue where, again, to the extent people are involved in outrage, and let people in Congress and the administration and others know, you know, that might start some sort of some process of accountability within the United States.
All right, Jim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Sure, and thank you very much for that study, too, man. It's really a remarkable piece of work, really important piece of work.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right, take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Jim Cavallaro from the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And Jim and the clinic, together with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, are the co-authors of a new report called Living Under Drones. And it's just a compelling, horrifying, and enraging report. So check that one out. And I also want to thank my first guest, Madiha Tahir, the filmmaker whose short, powerful new documentary, The Wounds of Waziristan, should be available for seeing very soon. Don't miss it. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Nelish Lalani and Jeff Pryor. And I also want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson. And last but not least, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, please do so on Facebook and Twitter. And like me, and you know the reason why, because we have very big plans for the very near future. And when I reach that certain magical like mark, we're all going to go on a big adventure, all right? I guess this is the time that I get to say, talk to you again next week, all right? We're going to go out now with a little bit more of International War Criminal. War Criminal.